Before we move to our parable for today, I want to just take a quick look at how the Gospels in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, how they came to be. There were many more Gospels that we have that were written, but these are the four in our Bible. Now, the Bible we also called the canon. That's what we refer to the Bible as. So we call these four Gospels the canonical Gospels because they are included in the Bible. Now, I'm not talking about canon that shoots big cannonballs. Canon with one N means rule. And as it applies to the Bible, it means the collection of books that have been historically identified as the Bible. The Bible, as we know it, is the Christian canon. So of the four canonical Gospels, the Gospels in our Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who can tell me which Gospel was written first? Close? Nope. Thank you for trying, though. Mark. Mark was written first. It's not the first one that shows up, but it was written first. Matthew and Luke were then written after Mark, and then John actually came last. So I want to particularly look at Matthew and Luke right now. Scholars presume that when Matthew and Luke were written, that they didn't know each other. They didn't collaborate in their writing. Each one was recording the established understanding of Jesus according to his particular community, and they were separate communities. When you look closely at Matthew and Luke, there are very clear differences between them. And the differences might be kind of hard for us to pick up because they're sort of nuanced, but some scholars devote their lives to studying such things, and I'm glad they do. And there's near universal agreement among scholars that in a general way, the nature of each gospel is quite distinct. They base those conclusions on things like the kind of Greek that's used, how sophisticated or unsophisticated it is, and the way that each one of the gospels takes a certain set of stories and puts them together in a different order and brings different focus to communicate a particular focus to a distinct audience. So there are these differences between Matthew and Luke, but there are also striking similarities between them. For one thing, they tell a lot of the same stories. For example, each one, when it was written, had to have access to Mark's gospel as the first one, because almost all of Mark is included in Luke and Matthew with very little changes made. It's like they just sort of copied down what Mark had to say and then added a little nuance of their own. But then we have these common stories between Luke and Matthew that are not found in Mark. So if Luke and Matthew were writing independently, if they didn't know each other, how is it that they tell the exact same stories if they didn't learn them from their common source of Mark? Here's what scholars say. They presume that there was actually another source from around the same time as Mark that was floating around in the first century. The second source no longer exists. It has disappeared, if it existed. So when the writers of Matthew and Luke sat down to write their Gospels, they had access to two scrolls. They had Mark. Each one included almost everything from it. And then they had another scroll, and each one incorporated all of the second scroll. Now, scholars have even given this hypothetical second scroll a name, and it sounds like something out of James Bond. They call it Q. Truly. Q is, when I first heard that in seminary, that just cracked me up. Q. Q is then a hypothetical document, doesn't exist now, but it must have existed in the first century, and it includes these stories that are common to Luke and Matthew that were not found in Mark. Congratulations, you made it through the two-source theory of how the Gospels came to be. You can wow your friends at cocktail parties with your knowledge of the hypothetical Q document. And the sermon has not even started yet. Our parable today is called the Parable of the Talents, as Jake told us. And it is one of those stories that is found in both Matthew and Luke, but it's not found in Mark. So some scholars say that the parable of the talents came from Q. Others disagree. They say that Matthew and Luke tell the parable of the talents really quite differently, and they didn't come from a common source. today we won't argue that. We'll stick with Matthew's version. So turn in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 25. And as soon as somebody gets there, call out the page number for everyone else. Matthew chapter 25. Page 28. Before we begin reading the parable, I just want to set the context for this story. Remember last week in Luke, Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan in response to a question that he had been asked by a lawyer. Well, according to Matthew's imagination, this week, Jesus sort of does the same thing. He tells our parable today because he's answering a question. So, to see what that question is, flip back a page to Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 3. Jesus is talking to his disciples and they ask him a question. Let's pick up the reading in chapter 24, verse 3.
When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will this be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?"
Jesus has just predicted to them that one day there's not one stone of the temple that would be left standing. In other words, he's talking about the end of the age. He's talking about the end of everything that they know and trust. And they're naturally a little curious about when this is going to happen. So Jesus launches into this long sermon about that. All the way through chapter 24, flip the page there, all the way into chapter 25. He starts telling the stories and teachings of the end times, which, by the way, do not clear things up at all. Who's surprised about that? He starts chapter 25, then, with a story about 10 bridesmaids. Sometimes it's called the parable of the 10 virgins. And five of them are wise, five of them are foolish. And then he begins our text for today. So as we read our parable, keep in mind that Jesus is answering the question, tell us when the end of the age is coming and how we'll know when it's here. Let's begin our reading then for today, chapter 25, verse 14.
For it is as if a man, going on a journey, summoned his slaves and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away.
Funny, we don't use the monetary unit of talent anymore, so let me tell you what that is. Remember a couple of weeks ago in the laborers in the vineyard parable, we learned that the daily wage for a peasant was 1 denarius. Well, a talent is equal to 6,000 denarii. So that first slave who gets 5 talents has just received from his master about $2 million in today's terms. In other words, Jesus is wowing his audience with these fairy tale amounts of money. The master gives the slaves no instruction, and then he takes off for Puerto Vallarta. No, he takes off. Let's see what they do with their big bucks. Verse 16.
The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded with them and made 5 more talents. In the same way, one who had the 2 talents made 2 more talents. But the one who had received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money.
So the slaves, they're really more like stewards, right? Each one has been entrusted with this large portion of money. The first 2 took it to the roulette table and doubled their money. Well, not exactly. They traded with it and they doubled it. The last steward dug a hole and buried it. Now, to us, that sounds a little crazy, but to first century Jews, that last servant would have sounded exactly right. And if you were lucky enough to have treasure, you didn't risk it. You buried it to keep it safe. I mean, think about the first century world. Remember our first century Jewish historian Josephus? Well, in one of his documents that's dated from the first century, Josephus writes that people always buried their treasure to keep it safe during war. Underground was the only way to keep it from being stolen. And so finding buried treasure was not unusual. There's another parable about that. So that third slave, for Jesus' listeners, is right on. That's what most of them would have done too, with a huge amount of money. Let's pick up our reading in verse 19.
After a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. Then the one who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 more talents, saying, "Master, you handed over to me 5 talents. See, I have made 5 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master." And the one with the 2 talents also came forward, saying, "Master, you handed over to me 2 talents. See, I have made 2 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and trustworthy slave. You have been trustworthy in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master."
So far, so good. It's sort of like the parable of the Good Samaritan, where the first 2 characters do exactly the same thing. It's a narrative device that sets up the listener's expectations that that third character, the third slave, is going to be different. Verse 24.
Then the one who had received the 1 talent also came forward, saying, "Master, I knew that you were a harsh man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you did not gather seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours." But his master replied, "You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter?"
So the third slave is like, "I was scared because you are a very bad man." And then the master agrees with him. The master says, "You're right. I am an unfair and greedy guy." Back to verse 26.
But his master replied, "You wicked and lazy slave, you knew, did you, that I reap where I did not sow and gather where I did not scatter? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return, I would have received with them what was my own interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one with the 10 talents.
Now, there are 2 little words in verse 27 that provide us with a huge tip to help us understand what Jesus is talking about. Those 2 words are "with interest." I'll come back to that in just a minute. Verse 29.
"For to all those who have, more will be given, and they will have abundance. But for those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless slave, throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth."
Thank you, Penny, for that uplifting story. I don't know about you, but I find this parable pretty disturbing just on face value. You don't have to dig far. The ones who have more keep getting more, and the ones who have almost nothing have even that taken away. Does that sound fair to you? Even though, as we look around it, absolutely, the comment, it sounds familiar. It certainly does. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And we see that in our world. Now, there are all kinds of interpretations out there for this parable. Some of them are humorous to me. Some of them are so self-serving and so inconsistent with everything we know about Jesus, as limited as that may be. So I'm just going to put out there, in my opinion, this is not a glorification of taking financial risk. Jesus is not saying, "God wants you to be rich, and so go out and invest your money in the stock market." In other words, you shouldn't read this story and head to Vegas to bet your fortune on black and hope to double it with 1 spin of the roulette wheel. Neither is this story about God-given talents. Often you hear it preached that way. It's not saying that God has given you talents, and so go out and use them. Don't bury them. Don't hide your light under a bushel, let it shine. Now that is very wise advice, don't get me wrong, but it simply is not the thrust of this parable. Jesus is talking here about money. Jesus talked about money a lot. Sometimes congregations complain when preachers talk too much about politics or money. They should be happy that Jesus is not their preacher, because he talked about those two topics more than anything else. This parable is about money. Specifically, it is about the charging of interest. Let me tell you what I mean. Numerous times in the Old Testament, many times, the practice of charging interest is mentioned. And every single time, the text says, "Do not charge interest to your fellow Israelites." Time after time, then, the Old Testament expressly forbids the charging of interest. Take, for example, in Deuteronomy 23:19, it says, "You shall not charge interest on loans to another Israelite, interest on money, or on provisions, or anything that you lend. Do not charge interest." This practice of charging or paying interest is addressed then numerous times in the Old Testament, but in all of the New Testament, guess how many times it's mentioned? Exactly once, here in this parable. Of course, this parable shows up in Luke 2, so it's two times, but it's the same story. A quick clarification. Just because something is common practice among ancient peoples does not automatically mean that it should be common practice for us. So I'm not going there. I'm not saying go forth and refuse to pay interest or to charge interest. What I am saying is that in this parable, charging interest is a sort of microcosm in which to consider what it's like to live in a world where there are competing visions and customs. Jesus characterized in the story the master as greedy and unforgiving, right? Because he expects interest to be paid to him. Jesus seems intent on provoking a debate among his listeners. Remember, Jesus and his audience were Jews, and they were living under Roman rule. Well, the Torah specified that Jews should not charge interest, but guess what? Romans charged interest. The man going on the journey, then, does not represent God. He represents Rome, a harsh man who is greedy enough to expect the payment of interest, even from those who have little. So yes, this story is about the charging of interest, but it's not only that as we read it today. By including this unique comment about charging interest, Jesus is drawing his audience to consider the tension between a personal faith perspective and an overriding law of the land that's contrary to what you believe. So what happens when those two things don't match up? Whose laws do you follow? Jesus was asking first century Jews, are you going to live by the Torah or by the practices of Rome? Do you live in a Jewish or a Gentile world? Do you accept God's law or Rome's customs? Are you Roman or Jewish? Can you be both? How can you be both? For Jesus, and really for us, it comes down to reconciling these two divergent visions of the world. The practice of charging interest is just a microcosm of that tension. The deeper issue is competing values. How do you live and interact in a world that demonstrates different values than you hold? If you live under the rule of a greedy tyrant who is a harsh man, get it? Do you play by his rules or yours? Do you play it safe and do what's expected? Or do you take risks and live boldly? What will we do with these two divergent visions? That is the pointed challenge of Jesus. And first century Jews pondered that decision in the context of the practice of charging interest. Our issues are different. Our divergent visions are felt in questions like, do we welcome refugees or reject them? Do all Americans deserve health care or only those who can afford it? Should quality public education be available to all, or to only a select few? Are we tacitly contributing to a reality where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? So with this story, Jesus provokes us to, where will we stand? Will we stand with the greedy or the needy? Whose rules will we play by? Remember the context of him telling this story, the question he was answering, what do we do with the time we have? Well, our days on earth are limited, every single one of us. How will we use the resources entrusted to us? How will we live in the time we have left?